MacCast, Thursday, December 11th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, life doesn't slow down for anything, does it? We are barreling into December already. Holidays have started. Usually things get kicked off right with Thanksgiving, which was, a little over a week ago, I guess, now at this point. And hopefully you are enjoying your holiday season. Things also never seem to slow down for Apple or Apple News. We got lots of great things to talk about in this episode. Lots of things happening in the community. We're going to be covering some ghosts of Apple's past. Throwing a little Dickens reference for you there, coming into play for them this week. Also, Apple kind of laying the law down on some developers, and not in a good way. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and updates to the Apple TV, as well as some of the latest Apple numbers, and an iOS update that was released. And then we may be getting the Apple Watch a little bit sooner than expected. We have all that in the news. And then I have a great little surprise for you. Our friend Victor Cahiao is back. I had him on a recent episode of MacCast Members, and he's going to share his Apple Watch thoughts with us. So I'm going to play you a little segment from that. Also, a little word of warning on using two-factor authentication, and a great tip from a listener on dictation commands in OS X Yosemite. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, I mentioned it's holiday time, and a lot of times that means budgets get tight. We're spending a lot more money on gifts and things like that. And if you've been thinking about maybe getting a new Apple product for yourself for the holiday season, or maybe even for a loved one, a great way to kind of offset the sting of that new spending is to sell your old devices. And I think one of the best ways to sell an old device is to use Gazelle. I've used Gazelle for years. And what I particularly love about them is how easy they make it to get an offer and get paid for your device. You have lots of options when reselling your old devices, but most of them are a big hassle. And that's the key with Gazelle. It is not a hassle at all. You get a quick, fair and upfront offer. They will even buy your broken devices. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You tell them the item that you're looking to sell, tell them a little bit about the condition, and right there on the screen, they give you a risk-free upfront offer, and they even offer free shipping, and in many cases will provide you a box. I use the free box option, and it's great. You just tell them you want a box. They send it off to you. It has great instructions right in on how to package up your device and get it sent back. And then once you send it in and they receive it, you get paid quickly, either by check, by PayPal, or if you go with their Amazon gift card option, you can get an extra 5% on your offer. And that's usually the option I always choose. The offer process takes less than a minute, so it's super quick and easy. And you want to do it today, because the longer you wait, the gadgets will slowly go down in value. So do it now, and you can lock in your price, and that gives you time to even make your new device purchase, get everything transferred over before you even have to send in your old device. And once you send it in, they also securely erase it. They make sure that none of your personal information is going to get out there. And they do this a lot. They've handled over 2 million trade-ins. They've paid out over $175 million to customers. And 90% of people using Gazelle have said they have had an excellent experience. And you can count me in that group. So what are you waiting for? Just take a minute. Find out what your iPhone is worth. Go to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. You know that I am not a big fan of talking about all of the lawsuits that Apple gets involved in. I just typically find it pretty boring to discuss, and it seems like there is a new lawsuit every week. But this week we got a story about a lawsuit from long ago in Apple's past that finally seems to be going to trial. It was a class action lawsuit filed like 9 years ago, way back in 2005, regarding the iPod and more specifically iTunes music and the lock-in that Apple had. And it's finally being allowed to go to trial. And so we're starting to get some new news and information this week. Just to give you a little background, it all started back in 2004 when Real Networks actually figured out a way to allow customers of their music downloading service to be able to transfer their purchases from Real Networks onto their iPods. And this is despite the fact that Apple had their FairPlay DRM technology in there and only tracks from iTunes were supposed to be allowed to be able to be played on an iPod. And by that, I mean DRM'd tracks. You, of course, could back then rip your own music in iTunes. MP3s without DRM would be able to transfer onto an iPod just fine. But, you know, back then, the record labels were DRMing everything. So Real Networks developed this thing that they called their Harmony technology. And as a matter of fact, not long after Real Networks did their hack, a number of other hacks surfaced, including one from the famous hacker DVD John, who hacked the DVD encryption system. He came out with a product called Double Twist, and there was also things like JHEM. So there was a lot of this happening, but Real, I think, was one of the first companies to kind of do this. And Apple, for their part, they didn't necessarily respond directly, but they turned around and pushed some software updates out and basically broke the Harmony hack around. So there was this whole back and forth at the time, and Apple was aggressively protecting their iTunes music lock-in. And so in 2005, a lawsuit was filed alleging that what Apple was doing was basically violating federal antitrust laws and California's unfair competition law because Apple was requiring customers to use an iPod to listen to music from the iTunes music store, and that was the only way to listen to purchased music. And as a matter of fact, in 2009, Apple was successful in actually removing a complaint in the lawsuit over their refusal to license the FairPlay technology to other companies. That was one thing that Real Networks was trying very aggressively to do, was to get Apple to actually just license them the FairPlay technology so that their music could be loaded onto iPods. But Apple was not interested, or, you know, it was never really clear at the time if it was just it wasn't enough money or Apple wasn't interested at all. I'm guessing the latter, but that's just my assumption based on how I know Apple likes to work. But you remember also in that year that Apple was successful in finally getting the music companies, the record labels, to actually allow them to remove the FairPlay DRM technology from iTunes purchases altogether. So then all this stuff sort of became moot. But I guess the lawsuit sort of remained and lingered, and specifically the part of it that claimed that Apple used the FairPlay technology to gain a monopoly on digital music downloads and portable media players. So that's what's being alleged. The lawsuit seeks to try and get a $350 million settlement, $350 million in damages for customers who had purchased iPod Classics, iPod Shuffles, iPod Touches, and iPod Nanos between September 12th, 2006 and March 31st, 2009. The plaintiffs in the case are basically saying that the lock-in caused consumers to be overcharged tens of millions of dollars for music and devices because Apple enjoyed this sort of monopolistic position in the market. And if Apple is actually found to be in violation of U.S. antitrust laws, the thing is it's not just a $350 million settlement, because there's a thing called the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914, and it mandates that the damages be tripled. So if this actually is successful, Apple could have to shell out closer to about $1 billion in settlement. So all this stuff is kind of coming to a head this week. They started up proceedings, and we're starting to hear testimony. And one of the bits of testimony is actually a video deposition that was given by Steve Jobs in 2011. And this was sort of at the height of, you know, when he was having his health issues right before he passed. So the media is trying desperately to get the video deposition actually released to the public. Apple is fighting it. I'm not really interested in that sort of part of the story because it seems a little bit seedy. Apple has come out and said that the media just really wants to exploit Steve Jobs. I'm not entirely convinced that is what they're trying to do. I think they just want to get at the information so they can hear specifically sort of what Steve's defense of the case was. But there also is just a transcript, I think a written transcript. And I don't know why maybe we can't get parts of that released without actually having to release the actual video. But regardless, because this trial has started, we're starting to get some information about the various testimony. And we've heard some things about what Steve Jobs said in this deposition. And one of the funny things, and it's totally in line with Steve's personality, I think, was that when he was asked about real networks in the deposition, he reportedly quipped, "Do they still exist?" And that was something I actually wondered when this information started coming out. Is real networks are still around? And they are. They're still around. They're still doing things. So you can check out their website. But in the tape, Jobs is also very evasive on most of the questions he gets asked. So he uses a lot of, "I don't remember," "I don't know," "I don't recall." And that's very likely. I mean, remember, this is 2011, and he's being asked about things that were happening between, 2005 up to maybe about 2009. And if you think back, how much can you remember about things you said or did even 2 years ago? That's kind of a tricky thing. But I'm sure also, he's playing the part and making sure that he doesn't disclose more information than he's really being asked about. And so then when he's asked about, if the labels were actually complaining about the real Harmony technology, he in essence responded that, it didn't matter because what Apple was doing was simply fixing holes that they saw in their DRM that were being exploited by hackers, people trying to hack around the DRM technology, and that their real goal was just to close those holes, and the real technology was merely, as Steve put it, collateral damage or just a consequence of them trying to plug those. So, like all lawsuits, and this is one of the reasons I kind of don't like to talk about them too much, is it's a lot of he said, she said, and getting at the actual truth is going to be pretty hard, especially when you have someone like Jobs who's not going to want to disclose exactly what was going on. So it's more likely that the plaintiffs for the case are going to get a lot more information out of a bunch of emails that they've subpoenaed. And we've started to get some testimony from those emails as well. And one of them, Jobs was reportedly concerned about the music service Music Match and wanted to be sure that their files couldn't be transferred over to an iPod. So really what this is coming down to is why was Apple blocking it? Was it really to get a lock or maintain a monopoly on the music download and MP3 player or portable audio player market? Or was it really something else? And what Apple is in essence saying is that, no, what we were doing is just trying to maintain our very delicate relationship with the record labels. As a matter of fact, Jobs was described as being very scared about breaking the digital sales terms that were stipulated by the record labels. And so Apple hasn't denied that they were doing these sorts of things, including going all the way down to not denying that they deleted music that was installed by competitive services via this hack around. Basically, Apple would display an error message if you had run one of these things. At one point, they pushed a software update. And if you had run this one of these hack arounds and gotten your non-Apple iTunes Store DRM music onto the iPod, what would happen was it would display an error message that would instruct you to restore to factory settings. And via that process, any of the offending music would actually be removed. And Apple claims that, again, they were concerned over the security of the hacked files because they didn't know what was going on with those. And in an email from to Eddie Q, Steve Jobs said that, the hacks were in essence like someone trying to break into their house. And the updates that deleted the non-Apple music files were intended to protect consumers from those break-ins. So Apple really saw it as patching these security holes in the DRM and maintaining these good relationships with the record labels. And they also contend there was plenty of competition in the audio player and digital music markets at the time. And I, you know, my mind, again, it's hard to remember that far back, but that seems to be the case. There were a lot of these competitive services. You didn't have to go with an Apple device. There were tons of cheaper MP3 players on the market. I even had a couple of them. And you had, you know, consumers had a lot of options. You could either go the Apple way or you could go the other way. And I definitely buy that the record labels were really putting a lot of pressure on Apple. And Apple tried very hard, I think, to get to the point where they didn't have to have the DRM in there at all. Steve Jobs always maintained that that was sort of a hindrance to the customer experience. It was unnecessary that if you just gave consumers the opportunity to buy their music and put a little trust in them, they would. And that's ultimately what happened, right? The record labels even went as far, if you remember back then, as to, you know, making that a way to kind of break what they saw as Apple's lock on the music market. They offered up DRM-free music to services like Amazon long before they allowed Apple to do that. So if anybody created the monopoly, and I don't even believe that one really existed, it was definitely the record labels themselves. So Apple's likely going to focus on the fact that there was a market for other players and devices. They're also going to probably focus on the fact that during that time, iPod prices continued to drop, which would be not indicative of a monopoly relationship. If you really had a monopoly, you would keep prices high, and prices kept going down, both on, I think, music as well as the players and devices themselves. And really, they were concerned that the record labels and companies would be agitated if music could be copied from other services onto Apple's devices, because it would show a failure of Apple's ability to actually protect their music. And that was something that they were insisting on. So they did not want consumers, the record labels, that is, they did not want consumers or customers to be able to copy music from one device to another. So I'm sure we're going to get a lot more information coming out of this trial. It remains to be seen whether or not the media will be successful in getting a transcript or getting the video deposition that Steve Jobs did. I'm sure there's some interesting nuggets and some things that we would like to know about in that deposition. It's also expected that both Phil Schiller and Eddie Q will testify at some point in the trial. So I'm sure we'll get information about their testimony as well. We'll kind of keep an eye on this one, but interesting, nonetheless, to see this lawsuit coming to light so many years later. I don't know what you think, but I am pretty appreciative of the fact that recently Apple has started to take a heavier and heavier hand on protecting customers' privacy. And specifically within iOS devices, they've really pushed the encryption technology and the privacy technologies to the point where customers are in control of most of their data, and there aren't these sort of backdoors that we hear about in other products and other systems to allow even the government or law enforcement agencies to sort of get into these devices. Apple has taken even away their ability in many cases to kind of have a backdoor into customers' data and devices. And I think ultimately that's a really good thing. But the U.S. government, they are not so happy about it. This week we started hearing about a case the Department of Justice is working on where they need an iPhone 5S decrypted and they want Apple to help them. They actually want to force Apple to help them. And they're trying to use something called the All Writs Act to force Apple to do that. It's basically an act, I think written in the 18th century, that can force a company to, or allow the court to use a writ or an order to compel a person or a company to do something. In this case, specifically to decrypt data. Last month, it was reported that Department of Justice officials had told Apple that, in essence, they were marketing their products to criminals and that eventually a child will die because of Apple's security design choices. This concept that there is no backdoor key. You know, we allow you to encrypt your data. You have the key. We don't. And recently, a federal judge in Oakland said that, you know, Apple is not required to offer any ways or doesn't have to attempt to decrypt or otherwise enable law enforcement's attempts to access this encrypted data. So, you know, regionally and locally, it seems like the law is on Apple's side, but the Department of Justice is not happy with that. And that's apparently not stopping them from trying to get Apple or force Apple to get at this information. The funny thing is that Apple claims it literally doesn't have the keys anymore. And I think that's really the case. So even if they can use this All Writs Act, and even if there is an order that forces Apple to help decrypt this stuff, I'm pretty convinced that they can't even do it, depending on which data and information. And if you want to know more about this stuff, something that Apple has been really good about, too, I think recently, is being transparent. So you can go to Apple's website. There is a page on security and privacy. I'll try to have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And it describes a lot of this stuff. It describes, you know, what's protected, how it's protected, and also goes into some information about these court orders and subpoenas and the frequency and volume of these requests that Apple gets from the Department of Justice and also from law enforcement agencies. And also, as much as they can, they disclose, because there's actually some legal restrictions on this, and we've talked about this in the past, they actually disclose, you know, how many of these they actually, you know, comply with or respond to. But more and more these days, what Apple's doing is getting in a position where, you know, they're taken out of the loop. They can't even respond to this stuff even if they wanted to. So law enforcement agencies and government agencies are going to have to take other routes and other methods to get at this data, probably specifically, you know, getting orders or going after the person themselves. I guess the problem for them in a lot of cases is a lot of that stuff is protected by, you know, the laws that say you can't or you don't have to do anything to incriminate yourself if you've been accused of a crime. So interesting stuff happening on the security and privacy front with the government and Apple. But, you know, I, for one, am glad Apple is working harder to protect consumers' privacy. And maybe the government just needs to get a little bit more creative at ways for getting at that information, or at least get some advice from a 7-year-old. I'm mentioning this because there was an interesting story this week, or just a funny story this week, CNN had about a cryptography professor, a guy named Matthew Green, and his 7-year-old son, who actually hacked, in a way, his dad's Touch ID sensor. See, what was going on was Harrison, this guy's son, early one morning, he wanted to play Angry Birds Transformers, and his dad's iPhone was passcode locked and protected, and he didn't know the passcode. He just wanted to play the game, right? But what he figured out was, well, dad's, you know, sleeping in the other room. So he snuck into his dad's bedroom early in the morning and simply borrowed his dad's thumbprint while he was sleeping, reached over, grabbed his hand, stuck the thumb on the Touch ID sensor, and then he was able to, you know, fling birds at pigs until his heart was content, or at least until his dad woke up. So there's ways to get at this information if you really want to. You know, of course, in a federal case or in a law enforcement case, you can't simply compel somebody to unlock their device with their fingerprint. I don't think you can, at least, again, because you have the right to not self-incriminate yourself. So if there's information on there, the government's going to have to figure out a better way to get at that. But I thought that was a funny story nonetheless and wanted to add that as part of this segment. And then the last thing, not directly related to this, but just something related to our general privacy on our devices, is something that Twitter is up to that I wanted to point out. A story came out this week that Twitter is going to use their official application and something that they've announced that they're calling App Graph to take an inventory of the apps that you have installed on your device and send that information over to Twitter. It appears what they're doing is they're going to watch for these X callback URLs. These are little special URLs that can do things like launch an app or take actions. It's actually, if you've ever used the app Launch Center Pro, I'm pretty sure that's the technology it uses to kind of allow automation and scripting on iOS devices. So there's all these commands that you can do to get different applications to do these things. And apparently Twitter's going to start using that to look at the kinds of applications that you have installed on your device. There's, I guess, a big list of all of these X callbacks and which applications actually use them. They're going to be cross-referencing against that and then sending that information to Twitter. Now, of course, they're saying we're just going to use that for our own purposes. We're not going to use it for, you know, anything nefarious. But if you don't like that sort of idea of Twitter, you know, looking at your device and looking at all the applications you have installed, you can disable it or stop that from happening by using the limit ad tracking options on your device. So you can go into settings, into privacy, and into the advertising and just simply turn that on. Now, you know, that may or may not be something you want to do. I actually kind of like the ad tracking on my device because hopefully, you know, if it's being used in a good way, it's going to give me more personalized and relevant ads in all of those applications that I have that are freemium and are displaying ads. You know, how well that works, that's a whole other debate we can have. But luckily, if you use the official Twitter app, you can simply disable this new app graph feature in the app itself as well. So if you just tap on the Me tab, tap on the gear icon, and then tap on settings, select the account that you want to disable it for. And it does sound like you have to disable it for each account. So if you have multiple Twitter accounts in your client, you're going to want to do this for each one. But then go under the privacy tab, and you can disable the tailor Twitter based on my apps option. And I love how they kind of don't make this stuff real transparent. You know, would that be really obvious what that feature is doing? I'm not really convinced. But the other way around this is to simply not use the official Twitter app and use some third-party client. But that may give some insight into why, you know, a year ago or so, maybe a little bit longer, Twitter started to try and sort of restrict the number of third-party Twitter clients that were out there. And they made it harder on developers to kind of do that by limiting the amount of API calls and keys per customer that they could use. So just wanted to make you aware of that in case you want to, you know, kind of tighten up your privacy with respect to your apps and you are, and if you're using the official Twitter app. In many ways, being an app developer, and specifically an iOS app developer, can be challenging. You have many obstacles that you have to kind of bypass and work through. You know, one is just programming, learning a language if you don't know it already. Programming can be hard and difficult. The process can be long and time-consuming. And even if you have a great app idea and you get all the programming down, you still have all of the designing and marketing that you need to do. You've got to figure out how to get your app discovered within a sea of millions of apps. That whole process is not easy. And nowadays, then, you also have to figure out how can you make a living 99 cents at a time or one in-app purchase at a time, especially when Apple then takes 30% of that, right? You've got all of these obstacles and things and challenges that you need to overcome. But a lot of developers do that, and a lot have been highly successful at figuring out this model. So it's not an insurmountable thing. But one way I really think that app development shouldn't be challenging is in understanding sort of the rules of getting your app to market. What I'm talking about is this week, you know, developers have once again sort of run up in many ways, and many different developers have run up against Apple's sort of esoteric or just really unknown app review process. And it just seems like now, so many years later, this shouldn't be an issue, but it continues to be and apparently is a problem. And this came to a head this week because a number of developers were impacted, and I just wanted to talk about some of them. First, the developer of the app Drafts was told that he had to remove buttons from the widget for his app. So one of the new features, you know, in iOS 8 is the ability to have widgets in different areas. And one of those areas is the today view of the notification center. So they had built this really cool widget, and it was already approved and it was out there in the market. And then they push an app update and they're told, oh, you know what, your widget can't have the button that allows you to launch the app and start a new document containing the contents of your clipboard. And that was basically, you know, one of the keystone features of this Today widget they had built. They were told that, well, Today widgets are for presentation only. The thing is this becomes confusing because there are lots of apps that use this kind of interactivity with buttons and things like that, do things that are beyond just presenting purely information in the Today view. So, you know, kind of like, what's going on? Are the rules changing? As a matter of fact, Apple demoed at WWDC an eBay widget that had an interactive button that would let you bid on an auction right from the Today widget. So, by example, Apple is showing interactivity, but then they turn around and they do this. And so it becomes really confusing. You have to kind of try and interpolate or figure out what exactly is or is not allowed, because you look at this and you go, well, that function of having this button should be allowed. But then you dig deeper and you look at what Apple's doing and you realize, well, they never leave the Today view. So is the thing that you can have interactivity, but you can't go outside of the widget itself? That's not what's really stated in the documentation. And that's exactly the issue, right? The rules are not clear. And you never know when you might get shut down because things get through and then you push an update and then suddenly they're not okay. And it seems to be the whim of the reviewer that you happen to get on the day that your app actually happens to be reviewed. And I think there's probably some truth to that. If you remember, pCalc had an issue recently with their widget. They had a widget that would allow you to do calculations right inside the Today view with a little calculator. And that got pulled. And then, you know, a news story came out and then Apple later reversed the decision. So they got that widget back. But again, that's a widget that kind of keeps you in that Today view. So is that what's going on? And back then, even the argument was, well, maybe it's because of how resource intensive, you know, how many resources or how heavy is that widget? It really needs to be light. But that was not something that was clear or specified. So that's just one example this week. We actually have three. So later, Panic, the makers of Transmit, they had just released Transmit for iOS. They were told that they had to remove iCloud Drive uploading capabilities from their app, which is, again, a key feature of the product. This ability to log into an FTP server, SFTP server, or WebDAV server, something like that, and then send those files from that server to another place, be it iCloud or Dropbox or Box.net. That's, you know, the whole point of having an app like Transmit on your iOS device. And so basically what they were being told is that they had to remove iCloud Drive from the send feature, you know, the little sheet that comes down that allows you to send files from one source to another. And specifically when they got the email, they cited App Guideline 2.23, if you're into that sort of stuff, which says an app cannot upload content to iCloud Drive unless that content was created within the app itself. So in Transmit's case, you're connecting to another server, you're grabbing a file from another place, and then you're sending that off to another app. But if you start to think about that, right, there are tons of apps that do this functionality that are already approved in the App Store. I have several of them on my iOS device. And so if this is really the case, if this is really the rule, it has huge ramifications for a lot of our favorite apps. And it gets even worse because when Cabell Sasser over at Transmit started looking into this and looking at removing the iCloud Drive uploading capabilities from the app, what they discovered is that that sheet is really just a couple lines of code. I think two or three lines of code to add that sheet. And when you remove the sheet, you also take away every other service that would be on that sheet. It's kind of an all or nothing thing. So you can't go in and granularly just remove one service from that sheet. Once you've enabled that sheet, then any service that you have enabled to integrate with the send feature is on that sheet. So by disabling iCloud, they also had to disable other services like Dropbox and Box.net, even further crippling their application. Now, once again, the hope is that Apple will kind of look at this and see this information and change the policy, or at the very least, maybe go back to the SDK and offer more granular controls. So this, if this does turn out to be the rule, then hopefully they fix the programming side of it so that developers can kind of get the features that they need and maybe not be in violation of some of the iCloud terms. And for their part, you know, Panic is taking really the high road. They're not blaming at all Apple, and they want to be very clear that they're not, you know, blaming Apple for this issue, or they're not upset about that. But I am, as a customer, you know, this is not something that I want. I want my apps to be able to have this kind of functionality, and I really think we should get to choose, you know, which services we want to allow uploads to, and not, but, you know, a lot of my other favorite apps, including my favorite file manager on iOS, Documents by Readle, you know, rely on this functionality. So that was another thing that happened this week. And it just seems to be cropping up again and again. So here we are many, many years later. This was a problem when Apple started first doing the review process, and seems to continue to be something that we don't have solved. And that's a little bit frustrating. But at the same time, you know, I'm very appreciative of the fact that we do have a curated app store and that Apple does have this review process. But I just wish that there wasn't kind of this collateral damage of, you know, apps that have really useful and legitimate functionality suddenly having to have to remove that functionality because of, you know, us trying to protect ourselves from the bad guys out there as well. So finding that balance is going to be key. And hopefully, you know, on a case-by-case basis, Apple can review and maybe approve these things. And over time, we'll kind of adjust the rules and make it easier for future developers. But this is certainly one challenge of app development I wish a lot of developers didn't have to deal with. If you fired up your Apple TV this week, and I'm thinking second or third generation Apple TVs, I'm never quite clear on which devices nowadays Apple is actually pushing updates to. But if you fired up your Apple TV in the past week or so, you may have noticed some additional new content, some new channels that Apple added. Apple pushed out an update. They added new content from the UFC Ultimate Fighting Championship, I think that is. I'm not real familiar with that. Something called The Scene, Fusion, and Daily Motion. So there's some new channels for you to check out. They also updated the YouTube app and gave it a bit of a redesign, and that's causing a little bit of controversy in our community. I've already received emails from some of you claiming that you really hate the new UI. I took a look at it, and I actually like it. It's quite a bit cleaner. It's more in line with sort of the latest design of the Apple TV interface. One thing that I particularly personally didn't like about it was when I went to set up my account. Well, first, I had already had my YouTube account tied into the app before the update, but after the update, I had to re-log in, and the new login process is more in line with like what you do to activate channels with your cable subscriber. So when you go to sign in, it gives you a URL that you have to go to. I think it's youtube.com/activate, and you have to activate your account on another device. So you have to have your iPhone or your iPad or be near your computer or run over to your computer, which I find really annoying. And you've got to enter this like security code. And not only that, I noticed, hopefully this isn't a problem. I've only logged into the app a few times since the update, but I authorized it. And then a day later I went back and I had to reauthorize. So I'm hoping that's not a bug. And I'm hoping my authorization actually sticks, but you know, that was a little bit annoying. And then I've also read or heard that part of the update, or a possible reason for the update, is that the new version of the app allows YouTube ads on videos. So you can expect, just like on youtube.com, that now you're probably going to see some of those pre-rolled ads in your YouTube videos. And there's kind of a good and bad to this, because prior to this, I think the Apple TV app was blocking any apps or any YouTube videos, rather, where the creator had opted in or had ads on their videos, because literally the app didn't support showing those ads, so it just didn't offer up those videos. So you probably have access to more YouTube content, but at the same time, a lot of that content is probably going to have advertising. But I don't take big issue with that, because the creators of these channels and videos and things like that, you know, that's how they get paid. That's how they get supported to create additional content. So if you have to sit through a little ad, not a big deal. I'm curious to see, I haven't seen an ad in the new YouTube app on the Apple TV. I'm curious to see if you have the little skip in X number of seconds on that like you do within the web interface. My guess is going to be not, but I have to wait till I actually see an ad to see that. If you have seen a new ad in the new UI and can fill us in on that, let us know. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But with this update, it got me thinking about some things. To me, it seems like Apple is moving down this path of turning the Apple TV into just another set-top box. And that's not something that I'm particularly excited or thrilled about. Apple really seems to be kind of scrambling in a way to kind of maintain this hold on the set-top box market as additional competitive products come into play, things like the Chromecast and the Fire TV. As a matter of fact, in a report by Park Associates, they claim that the Apple TV has now slipped to third in terms of market share for streaming media devices. They've now fallen behind Google's Chromecast. Apparently, the Apple TV now accounts for 17% of the streaming media device market, now behind Google's Chromecast, which is at 20%, and both of those are still behind the Roku, which is the most popular, at 29%. And then the newest player in the market, Amazon's Fire TV Stick, they're in fourth place, but they've already bumped up to about 10% share, and they haven't been around for very long. And they also say in that report that 10% of U.S. households have purchased a streaming media player in the first three quarters of 2014. And what's interesting about that number is that matches the data for all households in 2013. So for all of 2013, 10% of households had purchased a streaming media player in just the first three quarters. We've seen another 10% added of 2014. So sales of these devices are going up, and the theory is that Apple is having to compete with all these other devices, and that bringing additional channels and content to the Apple TV will kind of help keep Apple competitive in the market. But I really think that all of these channels and sort of content deals are the wrong thing for Apple to be chasing. It really turns them into just another player, and that's not what I like to see from Apple. You know, it seems like they should be trying to revolutionize or change the market and the way we find and consume TV content. And this is not feeling like that sort of thing. And I commented on this on my Twitter feed, and it stirred up a lot of response and reaction. So I wanted to talk about this a little bit. And one of the questions I have is, you know, is cord cutting and a really big thing? Is this even a market that is worth Apple going after? And some recent studies show that only about 2.9% of U.S. pay TV subscribers are very likely to cancel their cable subscriptions this year. So by that theory, it's saying, well, a lot of people aren't cutting the cord. But I think there's a little chicken and egg thing going on here, because a lot of us who want to cut the cord are being held hostage in terms of our content by the cable companies. And adding these channels like Apple's doing and these other streaming devices are doing really just perpetuates that lock-in, because in order to get access to the content on your streaming device, you still have to have that cable subscription. You have to authorize that cable subscription, and it really doesn't add a whole lot of extras to the experience. It basically just gives you another set-top box that is an on-demand media player, but it's still tied into your cable TV package. It's not doing anything to change the way we find, watch, or experience television. And I really don't feel like, you know, what's happening with the Apple TV is an example of what Steve Jobs had said when he quote-unquote cracked, you know, next generation or the next generation TV experience. You know, it feels more like more of the same. you know, setting up things with these hard, lame auth codes and having to have a second computer to set it up and, you know, just looking at the device itself now with all these channels, you turn your Apple TV on and it starts to feel like you're, you know, I've got 300 channels of stuff that I could potentially watch, but maybe not really because I don't actually have that as part of my cable subscription package. And oh, by the way, it's now really hard to find the content that I want and, you know, esoteric sort of channel names. What is this? I don't even know what content this channel offers up. It's just starting to feel like the same confusing experience just in a different package. It's now on this on-demand streaming sort of thing. And I believe that Apple has a vision and a plan for something better, and that it's just encountered so many obstacles in the path to getting to that, and a lot of the obstacles just seem huge, that they're now just looking for an easier way rather than trying to unblock the path. And the problem is that I think once you get too far down that path of concessions and compromises, it gets hard to find your way back. And I worry about that a little bit. And again, I'm throwing this out there just to kind of start up the conversation. I do think that Apple has this bigger plan and vision, and I don't think necessarily that they've lost their way. And I also don't think, and I don't want to be confusing on this, I'm not angry that Apple is adding these additional channels and content. I know a lot of people get value out of them. Those people with cable subscriptions want to have more choice and options on their Apple TV. I think it's good for Apple to remain competitive in the market. But at the same time, I have regrets about that because I think it loses the focus and the vision of where they need to be. And I just worry that if that becomes too fragmented, if the compromises become just the way, that we'll forget about what we really want the Apple TV to be. What I love about the Apple TV is what it didn't offer when we didn't have all these channels. All of the things that it shouldn't be or isn't, I think, are ultimately more important. And that's something that Apple has always focused on with their products. And I think it's one of the things that really makes them great is, right, it's distilling the product down to just the essentials and the things that make the customer and consumer experience better. And all of these channels, to me, don't feel that. You know, if you want channels, you can just get an $80 to $150 a month cable subscription and then, you know, buy a different product. Get a Chromecast, a Fire TV, Roku. Get all your channels on there. I don't want those. I want something different. I want my Apple TV to be the thing that offers the what I'm going to call the Atom channel. Just the content that I want. Just the shows that I want, regardless of where they came from. I want it to be able to be easy to find that content and play it when and where I want to play it. And I don't want it to be tied into a cable subscription package that I really don't want. And yes, you can do this now by buying shows on iTunes, and that's really kind of how I'm doing it, and it's how I'm using my Apple TV. Oh, and I also need to point out, I get that I can hide all of those extra channels and content that I don't get on my Apple TV, but again, I really think that's missing the point. They're the ultimate point that I want to make is, you know, I don't want that stuff, or more importantly, I want to be able to pick the shows that I want and sort of enable those and put those into a playlist is an awful word to say, but, you know, kind of like my own little channels of content. And when you start looking at this, you can really get this done with the current product. So why does it need to be more? Why does it need to sort of kowtow or cater to the lock-in that the cable companies are trying to do? And as example, I will, you know, point to the fact that you can, for $40, pretty much around $40 US, buy a season of a TV show. And so that means I could buy 2 to 3 television shows per month, which would represent 24 to 36 shows per year for the same price that I would pay for a typical cable subscription package. Now, I'm playing a little loose with the numbers here because I'm quoting the price if you were paying full price for your channels. A lot of times the cable companies are now offering you, you know, a 12-month or 6-month discounted price. But that's not the real price that you ultimately pay. That's just the thing that they sort of trick you and lock you into paying, and then, you know, 6 months later, suddenly you're not paying $30 a month for your cable package, you're paying $80 a month, right? It's the whole kind of bait and switch, and that's the kind of crud that I hate. So I think between buying season passes on iTunes and then coupling that with streaming subscription services like Netflix and Hulu, things like that, you have kind of a nice custom package, and that's more the direction I want to see Apple moving in. You know, why do we need more than that? You know, I think the focus should be on bringing that season price down or getting to the point where we can actually have a subscription service that we just pay for iTunes, you know, much like iTunes Match for music. I want iTunes Match for TV, or I want a subscription service where I can get access to all of the TV shows and content that are on iTunes. You know, of course, Apple's going to have to address the whole discoverability and searching part of this equation as well. But I really feel like that's what they should be focusing on, and not so much on, you know, trying to compete and have a Me Too product in the market. And the more of these channels we sort of get, the more I start to feel like that's just where Apple has conceded. It conceded the war, and I'm really hoping they've only conceded the battle, but I do sometimes question that. So I don't know. What do you think? I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Let's talk numbers a little bit, and not the application numbers, but more Apple numbers. It seems like every week analysts are crunching various numbers on Apple, and I see these reports come across my feed, and I never really know what to do with them, because I think by themselves these numbers are interesting, but a lot of times there's not really enough there to kind of make up a whole entire segment with just one sort of set of numbers. So I thought maybe what we might start doing is kind of grouping them together and taking a kind of what I'm going to call a weekly look at Apple's box scores, basically, just like you would in sports. You know, you got all these little different numbers, and they tell you interesting things about what's happening or going on with your favorite team, or in this case, you know, our favorite company, Apple. So one of the numbers that I saw this week is regarding the Apple Watch, which is on the horizon. UBS claims that smartwatch interest is growing, and I saw this one over at Mac Rumors. So the tip of the hat to them. They did a study with about 4,000 participants, that is UBS, and across four countries, and the survey showed that about 10% of the respondents said they were very likely to buy a smartwatch in the next year. But that number, you know, doesn't tell us a whole lot. So UBS used that to kind of extrapolate exactly how many Apple Watches they thought Apple may sell in the first year of sales. So they took that 10% number and they looked at the number of Apple customers that had a compatible device that would work with the Apple Watch. So I think that's the 5S, the 6, and the 6 Plus, and took 10% of that number and came up with 24 million Apple Watches potentially sold in the first 9 months. That is if 10% of Apple's customers with compatible devices actually buy an Apple Watch. Now, when you stop to think about that, that number may be a little bit high, right? Because it assumes that 10%, that 10% of people who said they're very likely to buy a smartwatch in the next year are only going to buy an Apple Watch. Well, there's lots of other smartwatches on the market. So, you know, of those most likelies, as a matter of fact, even in the UBS report, they said that most of those folks were considering buying a Samsung smartwatch and not an Apple Watch. But UBS thinks that that will actually change once the Apple Watch is released. So, you know, are we going to see 24 million Apple Watches sold in the first year? I've seen numbers anywhere from about 12 million. 24 million seems to be the highest in the first year. I think we also had some numbers that said in 2016, Apple will probably sell around, I think, 50 million Apple Watches. So it's expected that the market is going to continue to grow. It's already growing very, very quickly. But, you know, time will tell whether Apple sells 24 million Apple Watches in the first year. Another little interesting number that came out this week came from a new study published by Kantar World Panel. They claim that Apple's iPhone 6 Plus has already captured 41% of the U.S. gigantophone market, and that's the phablet market for those of you who prefer that moniker, but I'm still in the gigantophone camp. I really don't like the phablet terminology. But despite that being a surprisingly large share of the gigantophone market, the important thing to know is that large screen phones still make up a relatively small part of the overall smartphone market. Just about 10%, although that number did quadruple from last year. Also bear in mind that last year's number was only about 2%. So larger screen phones making up about 10% of the market. That's actually smaller than I thought it was, just based on all of the reports before the iPhone 6 Plus came out that everybody wants larger screen phones, right? You would have thought that would have been a lot larger, but the Kantar numbers show otherwise. And as a matter of fact, within the iPhones themselves, the iPhone 6 is actually Apple's top-selling phone, according to Kantar, making up about 33% of all iPhone sales. The iPhone 6 Plus is actually ranked fourth among Apple's own devices, with the iPhone 5S coming in at second at 26%, and the often claimed to be quote-unquote failing iPhone 5C in third place with 18% of iOS device sales. So even though larger screen phones are on the rise in terms of their popularity, they, as you can see, are still far from the most popular devices that Apple is selling. And then finally, a misleading headline and some numbers from the Financial Times based on some IDC estimates that claimed Apple has lost its long-standing lead over Google in the U.S. education market. Now, luckily, the folks at Apple Insider are on top of this kind of thing, and they broke down the report and the numbers. As a matter of fact, the IDC estimates were looking at just collective shipments of netbooks running Google's Chrome OS sold to U.S. schools, and they showed that those units surpassed iPad sales in the September quarter by about 13,500 units. But the thing is that doesn't represent the entire education market and all of the devices and products that Apple sells into U.S. education. So simply saying Apple has lost its long-standing lead over Google in U.S. schools is misleading at best, and probably just bad, you know, reporting and a bad headline. As a matter of fact, later in the report, they even go on to contradict their own headline, saying that Apple retains a slight lead over Google in terms of all products that they sell into the education market. So yes, maybe there's some shifting there, but probably, you know, not very likely, and it's not changing as drastically as the headline would have led you to believe. So as we've talked about on the MacCast in the past, you always have to kind of do some drill down and a little bit more research. Don't rely on just those headlines when you're looking at the stuff in your feeds. I need to let you know real quickly about an update to iOS. iOS 8.1.2 was released. It contains bug fixes and reportedly addresses an issue that caused ringtones purchased through the iTunes store to be removed from your iOS device. So if you noticed after upgrading to iOS 8 that you were missing ringtones, you probably want to download this update. And also, Apple advises that if you are missing ringtones and you need to restore them, that you visit a special website that they set up, itunes.com/restore-tones, and you need to do that from your iOS device, and then that should get your ringtones back once you've updated to the 8.1.2 update. So run your software update on your iOS devices or within iTunes before trying that URL. And another little minor update that Apple did that is significant, though, is Apple also updated the Find My iPhone feature on iCloud.com to finally use Apple Maps instead of Google Maps. And I'm pretty sure this last or latest change eliminates most, if not all, of the Google Maps content from Apple products. The one area I haven't been able to test is when you send email directions from Apple's Maps app on either your iOS device or your Mac, if you send that email to someone who's on a PC, it has an Apple or a maps.apple.com link, I think, in there. But when you click on it, if you're on a PC, in the past, what it would do is connect to Apple servers and then redirect you to Google Maps. Because when you're on a Mac, it connects to Apple servers and then launches either the Maps app on your iOS device or the Maps app on your iPhone. So I don't know if that behavior has changed, if Apple has made a web-enabled version of maps.apple.com that you can access on a PC. That's one thing I'd like to test. I don't think they've gone that far yet, but I'm assuming at some point they'll eventually get there. And then not long after Apple released the public update for iOS 8.1.2, they also released their second beta of iOS 8.2 to developers. They noted that it contained additional support for Apple's WatchKit SDK and also fixed some issues related to international languages. And that's kind of what they're having developers look at. The one thing I'm wondering is if iOS 8.2 is going to fix a number of the issues that have been reported and still seem to be continuing to linger in iOS 8.1. We talked about a few of these last week, but one that is particularly annoying to me is Spotlight searches not working on my iOS device. I'll often go into Spotlight, do a search, and just get zero results. And I was hoping the 8.1.2 update would fix that. It didn't. So hopefully that's a fix that's coming in 8.2. And I know there's a number of you still suffering from network and Bluetooth issues with 8.1. I don't know if 8.1.2 addressed any of those either. Those seem to have gone away for me with the 8.1.1 update, I believe. But if you're still having issues or if you've noticed anything that 8.1.2 did seem to fix, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, it's looking like Apple Watch production might start sooner than expected. We had heard most recently that Apple had had to bump back watch production to late in February, but now we're getting some news, this time from G4Games, which has reported accurately on some Apple rumors in the past. I saw this over on Cult of Mac. Their report seems to suggest differently, the one from G4Games. They say that Apple's suppliers have had some breakthroughs in some of the yield issues that they had been having in critical components for the Apple Watch, specifically the processors and the displays. And now they claim that Quanta, who's believed to be Apple's main manufacturer for the Apple Watch, Quanta could start production as early as this month. It's being also reported that Quanta has been expanding its production workforce in preparation for the Apple Watch. They reportedly had added 8,000 workers to their workforce and are supposedly wanting to add another 10,000 to meet Apple's demand. As far as what that demand is going to be, they're expected that once things get rolling, that they will be producing about 3 to 5 million units for the launch of the Apple Watch, with ultimately producing 24 million units by the end of 2015. And if you were listening earlier to the UBS number that we quoted for the Apple Watch sales or predicted Apple Watch sales, it's exactly the same. I don't know if that's purely a coincidence or just sort of confirmation that that 24 million number by the end of 2015 might be the number Apple reaches. Now, if 24 million units is the actual number, and if 3 to 5 million units at launch is the actual number, that would constitute, I think, an astronomical success for the Apple Watch. And the reason I think that is because I started to go back and think about the numbers that we had been hearing about for smartwatch sales prior to, you know, Apple's potential release or imminent release, I guess I should say, of the Apple Watch. And in all of 2013, only 3 million smartwatches were sold worldwide. And for 2014, the best numbers I could find were latest ones from NPD Group. They looked at smartwatch sales from October 6, 2013 to May 25, 2014. And they showed over that time period just 500,000 smartwatches. Half a million had been sold in the U.S. Now, that's a U.S.-only number, so we can extrapolate. I think I had seen numbers as high as 1 million, maybe globally. But, you know, that's only 1 to 3 million units total for an entire year. We're talking about 3 to 5 million for the Apple Watch at launch. So that would be a huge bump up. And you might be saying, well, what about fitness bands? Because the Apple Watch also kind of covers that category. Well, even if you include fitness bands, the latest numbers I could find for that were from Juniper Research, and they suggest that about 19 million fitness bands are in use this year in 2014. And so 24 million smartwatches by the end of 2015 would blow away even just the fitness band market. And I have a feeling that, you know, that's much a much bigger and more popular market than just smartwatches. So it's looking like the Apple Watch is going to have a huge impact in the smartwatch space. And I don't think that's that surprising, but just how big it will be remains to be seen, obviously. We have to wait for Apple to actually enter the market. And that leaves the one big question that the GE for Games rumor doesn't answer, and that is, when is Apple actually going to ship the watch? So even if they start production in January, when is it going to actually be in our hot little hands? Well, earlier you remember that there were rumors Apple was trying to target a February launch. Does that mean if they've bumped up production that we'll get something for, say, Valentine's Day? Possibly, but I don't really think so. I think we're still looking at more of an April, May launch time frame, but I could be wrong, and I actually hope I am, because I'd love to get my hands on an Apple Watch next month. How about you? Last time on the MacCast, we talked about a missing bit of functionality, or what appeared to be a missing bit of functionality in the usage settings in iOS. We had Andy, who we were trying to help out, who was having an issue with the cached music from his iTunes Music Match subscription. And one of the ways he had dealt with that in the past was to go into the settings usage into the music category. And in there was a button to delete all downloaded music. And it was sort of right there in the user interface. And now it appeared in iOS 8 that there was not a way to do that. And I couldn't find it myself. So I wasn't surprised that Andy wasn't able to do either. We talked about it on the last show, and many of you emailed to let me know that there are actually a couple ways that you can still do that. The functionality is still in there. It's just not quite as obvious as it used to be. So what you do, and I don't know how I missed this, I probably should have tried this just based on my knowledge of iOS, but what you need to do is just go into Settings, General, Usage, Manage Storage, and then, you know, find the music category, click on that, so you drill into that section, and then in the, you know, under the area that says All Music, just simply swipe left to right across the All Music item. And then, of course, you'll get the familiar little delete option. And you can just tap delete, confirm you want to delete all the music off your device, which it will actually do, so be aware of that. Away you go. I don't know if that will actually clear all of the cached streaming files. My guess is that it really doesn't. That data's kind of in a little secret protected area, so you might need to use some of the other methods that we talked about in that last episode, but that's how you do it. A number of you also pointed out that you can also, on that same screen, on that music screen under Manage Storage, you can also simply tap on the Edit button at the top of the top right corner of the screen, and that will give you the little delete icons next to each item, and you can tap on that, and that will give you access to the delete button. But I think the whole swipe left to right across an item, which is a common gesture in a lot of areas if you want to delete something, by the way. So just try that gesture. I think it's a little bit quicker and easier to access. But thanks to everyone who wrote in to let me know about that. As promised at the top of the show, I have a special treat for you now, because if you've been listening to the MacCast for a long time, you know our friend Victor Cahiao. I'm sure you've heard his voice, and he's shared his opinions with us on many episodes of the MacCast. As a matter of fact, he was part of our Three Amigos crew. Well, if you've been listening for a long time, you also know that Victor took a break from podcasting for a while. Well, he started to get a little more active on Twitter and things like that. So I reached out to him to see if he'd be interested in coming on the MacCast, and he did. So he was on a recent member episode of the MacCast. So if you are a MacCast member, you may have heard the segment that I'm about to play for you. But I wanted to play part of that episode because Victor shared his thoughts on the Apple Watch, and it was something that I was curious to hear from Victor, and I thought you might also be interested in hearing too. So here's my conversation with Victor Cahiao about the Apple Watch. Well, the last thing I kind of wanted to get your take on is the future, the thing that's coming down the pike, and that is the Apple Watch.
Yes.
I guess the place to start with that is, have you gotten into smartwatches at all? Like, do you have that kind of device?
No, I like watches, analog watches, and have several nice ones, but I have not gotten at all into the electronic watch space.
How deep are you into the watch culture? Because I know some guys like Dave Hamilton's pretty deep into it. I've learned this, and I think Brian Chaffin, also over at the Mac Observer, is kind of a watch guy, and I've been hearing from more and more watch people.
And neither one of those guys. Are really into it.
Right, okay. So you're not in that camp. But you're a person who appreciates a nice watch, analog watch, and wears one.
I have a couple of them. I was bequeathed a Rolex from my stepfather after he passed away. And that's near and dear to me. Right. And that is part of the interesting equation here, especially with the edition version of the Apple Watch, you know, because how do I hand that down to my son? You know, I know I can give him the Rolex, but
right,
how are they going to work that out? That's been much talked about.
What's your take? Do you think it's even something they're considering, that there needs to be sort of this heirloom quality to this, you know, high-end device? Or do you think it's just for the... I kind of get the impression and always felt that it was just for the people who just wanted to have a bit of flash and wanted to spend the money. It seemed like to me it was for the celebrities and the rock stars, just so they can say, yeah, I have this one, and where money's no object to them.
Yeah, maybe. I'm really with the Gruber camp on this one. I really think the top-end edition watch is going to be at least $5,000.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that Apple is going for that watch aficionado, high end. You know, it's a whole new fashion statement for them. They are going beyond tech, and that is not even a throwaway, even for the guys who have big bucks. I guess I can't compare myself with them,
right?
But if that is the case, then they must be thinking about a very limited amount of people that have that kind of money, the one percenters, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's my take, is I think it is just a one percenter kind of thing, and those folks are going to buy one. And when the new edition comes out, they're going to drop another $5,000, $10,000 on a new one. I've heard from some higher end watch, you know, collectors and folks who kind of have this theory that there'll be some sort of pod or some sort of module, and you can, you know, take your $5,000 watch into the Apple store next year, and they'll sort of, you know, replace the guts, and you keep the casing, right?
Yep, so I've heard that.
The casing. I don't know that I see that happening.
Not with the way that Apple likes to make things thinner, like every time they put out a new version. You know, that's the problem. Go ahead.
And my question there, because I thought that exact same thing, is with watches, though. You know, as a piece of jewelry, as a device, there's a certain look, and there's a certain cachet, I think, to the, you know, the heirloom aspect. That gets back to that heirloom aspect, right? Watches get thinner and sleeker and change designs and stuff like that. But collectors appreciate the old style. You know, it's sort of like, I have this antique one. I have this one that, you know, was designed, and this was the design when it was produced, and that's what makes it cool.
That's true.
But I don't know that an Apple Watch would have that kind of cachet, but maybe they're factoring that in. You know, it's like, my son does have my original, you know, 2015 Apple Watch, and it's 2030. It seems weird to think about that, but I mean, that's sort of how people feel about analog watches. Is Apple going to make that transition into the, you know, digital space?
But they're still going to have battery life to contend with. There's no way that, you're not getting that 15-year battery life out of even.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's where this concept of, you know, you continually go in and they just keep sort of upgrading the guts.
That would be a good way to do it. I mean, I've heard that theory, and I think that would be good.
I don't think it's going to happen, though. I think it's just, you know, like all of our digital devices, like an iPhone or everything else, like that. And I know that, you know, environmentally, this is not the best thing, but I think it's a disposable product. I think the new one comes out, and you either resell your old one, and it maybe has a year or two life left on it, you know, to somebody else. But and then you just buy the new thing.
Yeah, I think the sweet spot is going to be that middle stainless watch. I think that that's where they're going to sell the most. You know, I believe the price point of between $600 and $700 will be for that, and that's going to entice a lot of people to jump
not
in.
Me.
Well,
that's still too rich.
Probably
for my
not
blood.
Me either.
At least but for the first generation, you know. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to be a sport guy as much as I want. I really want this the middle tier one, but I think it's going to be priced out of what I'm willing to pay for a first gen product.
I don't know, given what we've seen about first generation watch kit stuff,
right,
if I'm even going to be enticed enough to get the sports one, other than the fact that, you know, maybe I'm doing this again and I'll do it for the fact of reporting out on it or something, you know, at $349. Because from everything that it looks like, the first generation through watch kit is going to be, you know, really taking baby steps, kind of like what we saw in the first gen of iPhones and apps. You know, it was very, very, very basic. And it looks like what they're only going to let like third-party notifications show up. But I guess the big difference is that unlike the iPhone, the watch will be able to respond to a third-party notification. I think that's cool. I could see a use for that. For example, if I forget to turn on my alarm at home when I leave the house, it sends me a notification today that I forgot to do it. I have to go into my iPhone. I have to go into that alarm app.
Right.
And I have to arm my alarm. Well, if through WatchKit, that was just a simple message and then a button that said arm system, that's pretty enticing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically a UI back to the phone app. So the phone app, you know, the sense that I get is the phone app in various ways, be it interactive notifications or glances or actual WatchKit apps, can provide some interactivity and interaction. But the core processing is basically happening on the on the phone, which it sounds very similar to sort of what they're doing with CarKit, right? Your phone is still the main processor, and the watch is sort of like the satellite display UI, you know, and it provides a customized UI for that interaction, but it's still communicating back, and the actual processing and implementation of that action is happening within the phone, at least initially.
Yeah, what I hope is that whatever chipset they put into and processor they put into version one will be able to be sustainable enough to get us through 2016.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, by that time, you know, the next version of the SDK will be out and we'll actually be running some apps within the watch itself.
Yeah, they said sometime in 2015, I guess they will allow developers to build native apps. My guess is they'll announce the availability of those tools at WWDC in June, and then we'll start seeing apps sort of coming out toward the fall, like native watch apps. So I think they fully plan that the S1 processor that they have in there to be capable of running, you know, third-party native apps. It's just they're not, I think they don't have the development tools quite shored up and ready yet. So,
yeah, but some of the stuff I saw, like looking at pictures in a watch, you know, I am not going to do that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, let's be realistic. I mean, scrolling through, you know, they showed all the different apps. I just can't see myself holding my wrist up in any situation and just geeking out with a watch.
Right.
Without looking like a total dork, you know, when I have my phone in my pocket.
No, it's like, I think some folks have written about this, and this is another take I wanted to get from you, because I think Rene Ritchie wrote up a really good piece recently and said, you know, its killer feature is convenience. You know, it's a 5, 10, 30 second experience sort of screen, right? Just got a notification. What was that? I'm going to glance at it for a couple seconds and I'm going to put it away. Or, maybe it goes a little bit deeper and I want to respond to that. And I have, you know, a canned response that I send back. But again, you're talking about a 20 second, 30 second experience, interaction.
He's spot on. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I mean, there is a lot of that you don't think about throughout your day. You know, think about the number of times you get a notification now on your phone and you're pulling your phone out of your pocket and looking at it and then putting it back.
True.
You know,
True.
that doesn't take a lot of time, but compare that to, you know, glancing at your wrist and you're talking, you know, a half a second here. But the number of times you do that throughout the day, that adds up. Or you get to something like, say, a payment system, Apple Pay.
Yes.
Right.
Now we're talking.
You still have to take your phone out. Now, if it's just on your wrist, you're already, you know, reaching over the counter to grab your package or whatever, right? That thing is already there accessible. So you're not saving a ton of time, but all those little, you know, 1 second here, 2 seconds there, things start to add up and it becomes a lot more powerful than I think it seems at first sort of brush. And the reason I know a little bit about this is because, you know, I have had a Pebble. I bought a Pebble specifically when Apple announced, or when we were hearing pretty strong rumors that Apple was going to do a watch device. And I really wanted to know, you know, is this a space that makes sense at all for anybody, or is this just a passing sort of fad thing? And my initial reaction was, yes, it's, you know, dumb. There's no need. It's a notifications on my wrist. Big deal. Right. Mm-hmm. But the more that I've used it and the more that the space is sort of developed and the more that developers are starting to realize this is about the interactions and the experience and, you know, the fact that this is Apple's forte, right, is the figuring out the experience and figuring out the use case before they bring the technology. Too many other guys brought the technology and then it sort of had to find its way, which is, I think, why the whole marketplace for smartwatches has sort of floundered. And why, when Apple releases their thing, people are going to get it. And we're already starting to see that. So what I'm getting to is my Pebble has become, I started wearing it again. I had sort of stopped wearing it, started wearing it again. Some of the more recent software updates, some of the more recent apps that are out for it are starting to focus on that experience, I guess. You know, that sort of interaction with the phone. And most recently, Jeff Gamet was talking about the Misfit. The little health device, what's it? It's not called the Misfit. The actual Misfit is the company. The device is called Shine.
Okay.
Which is like a little button thing that you wear and you can get it on a wrist strap or a pendant or what have you.
Right.
It does tracking and it has an app that it integrates with HealthKit. And I've been wanting to sort of have some things that integrated with HealthKit. Well, I found out Misfit has a Pebble Watch app and you don't even need the little Shine device. It will use the Pebble as the tracker and still integrates with their app and it still integrates with HealthKit. So I started using that and it's been great because it has a sleep monitor. So it monitors my sleep pattern, it monitors my steps, and then it all integrates with my iPhone back into HealthKit. And so that sort of holistic experience, I think, and the convenience of I don't have to have a separate, you know, little bug tracker thing, or I don't have to remember to put my Fitbit on in the morning. I'm just going to put my watch on and it's going to handle all that stuff. Those are the kinds of killer things that I think that's going to change the opinion with, like, smartwatches. That's why I think, you know, what Apple's doing is they recognize the watch is going to be this sort of experience that can interact in many ways with many parts of their whole ecosystem, be it HomeKit or HealthKit. Or, you know what I mean? Like, we're starting to see it all come together, and Apple's really, I think, pulling it off in a big way. So that's where, again, where this idea of convenience comes in, and Apple Pay, you know? And so it's going to be Apple Pay, it's going to be health stuff. And what's great is it's going to interact in at so many levels and in so many ways, it's going to be very personal why you have that watch.
I think about it this way. If they can give me 5 killer use cases,
right,
to use the watch at $70 a piece, I'm in.
Yeah, and I think you're going to have more than that, but I think 5 is going to be easy for them to pull off.
I mean, to me, you know, 5, they've, you know, Apple Pay's 1, so that's down. You right. just talked about some HealthKit stuff that probably is 2 or 3.
Right.
So only a couple of more things, like what I mentioned with my home alarm, just, you know, ease of use, HomeKit integrations for certain things. Those are the kind of things that will make me go, yep, okay, that's a 30-second experience, to use Rene Ritchie's words,
right,
that is worth $70.
Yeah, I don't know if he said 30-second experience. I kind of just extrapolated that from what he was saying. But, you know, the point was, yeah, it's about these little interactions, right?
Right, short burst use cases. Yeah. So it'll be definitely an interesting February, March, I think, or March, April.
Yeah, that's the other thing. When do you think this thing is happening? I'm guessing. I still think it's going to be really late. I think if we get it, you know, the end of May, we'll be lucky. But
yeah, I'm hoping for April.
Me too. I hope sooner than later. But yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm definitely getting one. I've already resolved that I'm going to have one. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, what those use cases end up being. And I think they're all going to, you know, again, even more so than the phone, I think they're going to be very personal.
I think part of the personal experience is going to be the whole bands, you know, yeah. All of the different bands, you know, how much those cost, tailoring this watch to your personality. I think that's where it's going to become much more like a fashion experience for all of us, especially if we like watches. They're obviously making it very easy to switch the bands and stuff. And the ones that I saw, there are some beautiful ones. So that's what's going to be interesting. It'll be interesting just shopping for them in an Apple store. Yeah. That experience will be unique in how you go about doing that at a mass market scale. That'll be interesting to see.
It's going to be interesting to see what third parties do. I'm assuming the bands are, you know, able to be developed by third parties as well. I don't think there's any technology in there where it sort of slides in and connects, at least. They haven't said that there is, so it seems like a pretty ubiquitous system. So I'd fully expect that watch bands are going to become like the to the Apple Watch, like cases were to the iPhone.
Wow. I mean, then now you're talking about really high-end, you know, the Kim Kardashian, you know, limited edition band that goes with your Apple Watch. I can just... You know, it's only $30,000 or something. You know,
I think there is going to be a whole new market because it seems like they just slide in, right? It's just like a sliding clasp sort of mechanism.
But no, the design is a thing of beauty. If you look at the pictures up close and the way it's been designed, I mean, industrial design wise, it already is a marvel even without seeing what it does.
Well, I'm sort of excited to see what happens in that whole space when Apple enters the market. They certainly weren't first, and they didn't pioneer a lot of the stuff, but I think they're gonna, like they often do, sort of reinvent the space and become definitely a dominant player, no doubt. I think they already are, and they haven't even released a product.
Yeah, I love the way they're marketing these days, Apple. I love the new openness, mm-hmm. and it's really been refreshing. That's one of the things I've really noticed in the last couple of years, and just their whole openness in general. The watch is a good example, you know, going outside to do some marketing at jewelry stores in Paris. And then just their overall openness as a company, maybe a subject for another day.
Yeah.
But it's really refreshing as an Apple user.
We'll have to get you back on and chat more.
Sure, man.
Thanks for taking the time. It was great to be able to catch up with you. And I look forward to seeing you more online. I look forward to hearing the new show with you and George. I'm sure it's going to be awesome. So you'll have to, you know, let us know when that drops so we can get the word out. But
yeah, absolutely. You guys go out there to articulate.info and you can read a little blog post and, you know, pretty soon we'll show number one will drop. And then from there on, hopefully you guys will join us in the conversation.
Awesome. Awesome. Other than there, any other places you want to send folks to kind of.
Sure. Join me on Twitter. Yeah. It's my funny name at VICTOR. CAJIAO. That's how you find me on Twitter.
Awesome. Thanks, Victor.
Thanks, Adam.
So there you go, Victor's thoughts on the Apple Watch. And at the end there, you heard the kind of second surprise that I have for you. Victor and our friend George Starcher have started up a new podcast. And I believe it just dropped on iTunes. So you can subscribe to it. It is called Articulate. And that is articulate.info is the website, and Articulate is the podcast. And I encourage you to go subscribe and take a listen. And it's really nice to have Victor back with us, and hopefully we can get him to come chime in on future episodes of the MacCast as well. Now let's jump back and talk a little bit more about security and specifically two-factor authentication. You know, if you've been involved at all in tech, or maybe even not in tech this year, that hacking has become a favorite pastime among lots of folks. It always has been. But just we've had so many breaches of security and break-ins on different accounts and credit cards and things like that. And one of the ways that you can combat that and further protect yourself is to enable two-factor authentication. It's actually something I've done on every account that I possibly can enable it in. So be it my Twitter or my Yahoo or Google, or even my iCloud account. I have all of that stuff enabled. Well, Owen Williams from the Next Web had enabled two-factor authentication for his iCloud account, but had a trying week this week because hackers tried to get into and access his iCloud account. Now, because he had enabled two-factor, he was protected and actually kicked in and locked those folks out of his account. And no, you haven't heard this one before because this isn't an issue of iCloud being hacked. What this is that someone tried to hack his account, two-factor kicked in and stopped the hackers, but then also began some trouble for Owen because when he went to regain access to his account, he was locked out as well from just doing a standard login. He had to go through Apple's I Forgot service to actually be able to re-enable his password. And this is actually documented. This is the documented procedure for if you get locked out of your account through, you know, false hacking attempts, or even if it was just you, you know, misentering your password, you know, enough times, you can get locked out of your account. And the reset procedure is to go through Apple's I Forgot service, which is iforgot.apple.com. And when you go there, once your account has been locked due to the two-factor authentication being enabled, the only way you can regain access is to use the recovery key that Apple issues you when you turn on two-factor authentication. So if you haven't done the two-factor authentication process before with iCloud, what happens is once you turn it on, it generates this recovery key for you, and they tell you to print it out, make sure you don't lose it. It's the only way, once you've enabled two-factor authentication, that you can get back into your account because Apple has no way of resetting things on their end. Now, unfortunately, Owen thought he had saved his key, I think, into a screenshot somewhere, but he couldn't find that key. And he was under the impression that, you know, maybe because he still had his device, he still had the physical device, and he still knew his iCloud login because that hadn't been changed because the hackers had been thwarted, that he should still be able to get into the account. Well, that does not work. You must provide, via Apple's process, the recovery key if you've turned on two-factor and you've been locked out of your account. So unfortunately, he wasn't able to get in. He wrote up a piece about it. Luckily, eventually, he found in his what he called ancient time machine backups, he did find that screenshot and was able to get in. But it was a frustrating week because he called into Apple's tech support, talked to a lot of various folks, and they basically said, you're out of luck. You know, once you are locked out in that way, if you don't have the recovery key, you're going to have to just create a new iCloud account. There's no way to ever get back in. So that just kind of reiterated this process that if you do enable two-factor with iCloud, make sure you absolutely print that out or put a copy of it and store it someplace secure, but where you know it is and where you know you can get to it if you need it, right? And so for me, I thought I'd give you my tip. The way I protected mine was I printed it to a PDF when I generated it. So when I was on Apple's website, it generated, I printed it to a PDF, and then I put that PDF as an attachment into a secure note in 1Password. Also within the note itself, I just copied the recovery key and placed that in the note. So I have it in the note plus in the PDF attachment in my 1Password secure encrypted keychain. Right? And it is stored there. I probably also, just as a secondary backup, should print a copy out and maybe put it in a fire safe or a safe deposit box. I know a lot of people do that. You want to put it someplace where you can get to it, but no one else can, because that's like the keys to the kingdom for your iCloud account if you're using two-factor. And if you're listening to this now and you're suddenly realizing, oh, this is a problem for me because I didn't save that recovery key, or I don't know where that recovery key is, and I've lost it, and you still have access to your iCloud account, you can go in and generate a new one. Again, this is long as you still have access to your trusted device and you're not locked out of your iCloud account. To do that, you can just go to the My Apple ID website. I believe that's myappleid.apple.com, if I'm remembering the URL right. Or no, it's just simply appleid.apple.com. You go to that website, log in, click on the Manage Your Apple ID option, and then once you're in, under your Apple ID, select Password and Security. And then from there, under Recovery Key, you can choose the option to replace a lost key. And then just simply follow the on-screen instructions. It should generate a new recovery key for you. And then make sure you print that out or put it into 1Password, store it in a secure location where you can get at it in case of emergency if you need to get back into your account. And note that when you replace your key, your old recovery key is going to be deactivated immediately and will not be able to be used to access the account. So if you do ultimately end up finding that again, make sure that you throw it away. So you might want to make a note or somehow indicate with your new key that this is the new key and the old one should be deleted. But that could be a hassle. But, you know, I think overall the advantages of enabling two-factor and the extra security are really important to protecting our vital data. So I still encourage people to turn it on. Yes, it's a little less inconvenient, but as we've talked about in the past, that's sort of the compromise with security is more security means a little less convenience. But I'd rather err and opt in the side of more security than having to deal with my accounts being hacked. And then finally in the show for this week, let's talk a little bit about dictation. One of my favorite features in OS X is the ability to dictate. Apple added it, I believe, in OS X. How long has that been with us? I don't even remember. I'm not even going to attempt to try. I can't remember if it came in Mountain Lion or Mavericks, but you know, the ability to be able to double tap the function key, which is the default way of accessing dictation and being able to dictate in any app, I absolutely love. This is something that came over from dictation on iOS. Well, Gary discovered this week that in OS X Yosemite, it seems like dictation can do quite a bit more than it could in OS X Mavericks.
Hey, Adam, it's Gary. I wanted to share something with you. I haven't finished listening to the current podcast, kind of spreading it out over a period of days while I walk the dog. I was doing some dictation work here at my computer, and I accidentally said, like, move up, or, you know, and then I said, well, move down. And it looks like there's new commands in dictation that I didn't know about. I don't know if this is just common Yosemite knowledge, but it looks like things that you used to be able to do in the old, or probably still current, versions of, what is it called, Dragon Dictation, you could do, like delete last word, highlight sentence, stuff like that. So I, not really knowing what the commands are, just started playing around, seeing what I could do, like move up. I'm like, why would anybody want to move up? But that seemed to come up, and you could see it in the dialog box. It tells you you've issued a command. So wondering what commands there are, I went and dived a little deeper onto the OS Yosemite site, and it looks like there are advanced commands that you can enable to use on the while you're dictating, which I think is great. Love it. Just looking at it, it looks like you have to enable them because they're not enabled by default, but yet mine work on my computer without them actually being turned on. So I thought, well, that's a little odd. But I'm still happy that they're there. So if they work on your computer, you know, you would go under accessibility and then down to dictation on the left, and you can see them all. And on my computer, the box that was checked for enable dictation commands was not checked. And so turning it off and turning it back on doesn't seem to make a difference in whether they work or not. But they work. So you can say things like highlight sentence, bold that, you know, it's just some really cool commands. So now I'm thinking, is there a list of these somewhere so I can keep them next to my desk? Then I can start teaching myself to learn these because that'll really make dictation easy. So wanted to tell you that. And also this last one is a question. And I haven't looked it up too much. I was just thinking about it over the period of last weeks. I keep my phone always turned on personal hotspot, because I like it that I can just call on that instant hotspot on my computer or my iPad whenever I need it. But you have to leave it turned on for that to instantly connect, otherwise it don't work. So the problem I'm having is I use my Mac when I'm at my desk as a place to recharge my phone, so I plug it in. And my computer automatically recognizes it as a tethered hotspot, because I think that's because I have it turned on. But yet I'm still connected to Wi-Fi. And on my phone it says, you know, hotspot connected. So I'm wondering, is there something I should be doing differently so it doesn't do that? Or I guess I'm not really that concerned that I'm using data, because it says I'm still using the Wi-Fi and my IP address is still on my Wi-Fi. Is this a bug, or if this is just the way it is? So I'm just a little concerned. I'm going to be using data at some point, so I feel like every time I do that, I got to turn it off, and then I forget to turn it back on, and then it voids my instant hotspot.
Hey, Gary, thank you for sharing the advanced dictation thing with us. I want to get to that here in a second and provide some additional information, but let me start with your question. As far as the hotspot goes, yeah, I would just turn it off in the settings when you tether your phone to your computer. I know it's a little less convenient, but I think it just works that way by default. If it's turned on, it's going to try and use that connect. Well, not necessarily use that connection, as you found out. It's going to use the default connection, but it will, you know, kind of enable that and have it turned on. I don't think there's any way to avoid that while keeping the hotspot turned on. I could be wrong on this, and maybe you know of a trick for it and can share that with Gary. But as far as I know, you know, the only way to do it would be to just physically disable it. I've even seen this where I've left my hotspot turned on and suddenly one of my devices will connect to it and I'll see that little blue bar up there. And I don't know why, because it's, you know, sitting there on my Wi-Fi. So it might be like my iPad, for example, will suddenly show that it's connected to my iPhone using the hotspot connection, even though it had a Wi-Fi connection. So I think a safer practice, so you just are doubly sure you don't use up all your data, is to turn the hotspot off when you are not using it. Kind of does defeat that new feature in Yosemite, though. But getting to the dictation command thing, that is a feature of OS X. Some of it is built into OS X Mavericks and earlier. Some of it is new to OS X Yosemite, and more specifically, the new stuff is really just a change to how things work in Yosemite. It's some features that existed prior to Yosemite, but it's been changed and expanded in Yosemite. So there's really two areas that we're addressing here. One is what I'm going to call the dictation commands. These are the things, like you noted, that are in software like Dragon's Naturally Speaking or Dragon Dictate, where you can actually say commands like new line or all caps or quote, end quote, and actually be able to dictate punctuation and sort of expanded things as you're, you know, dictating out a sentence or something like that. And Apple does have a support article that lists those commands. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. So that's been around. It works in OS X Mavericks. It works in, you know, any of your Macs that support dictation, or also your iOS devices that support dictation. The other thing, though, that you're noting, where you can say things like page up and page down, and you can open applications, you can say, you know, open this app, open that app, that is actually expanded functionality or merged in functionality in OS X Yosemite. And those kinds of commands actually go all the way back to the OS 9 days, believe it or not, and maybe even earlier. But you may remember something called speakable items. It was part of the speech features in OS 10, and there's a bunch of voice commands that you can use with your Mac. So if you have a pre-OS X Yosemite machine, the way you actually enable it is you go into System Preferences under Accessibility. This would be in Mavericks. I think in earlier versions, there was like a speech system preference pane. But now you go into System Preferences, Accessibility, Speakable Items. And this is for Macs prior to OS X Yosemite. And in there, you set the Speakable Items option to on. And what will happen when you do that is you get this little floating round UI element, and the design of that thing is the one that, you know, it looks exactly like it did back in OS 9. You get this little floating thing, and in the middle of it will have a key. By default, I think it says escape, and that is the key that you can press on your keyboard to enable your Mac to start listening for commands, and then you can speak a command and it will execute that command, and then you let go of the escape key, and then, you know, it does its thing. So if you want to know the list of commands for speakable items, what you can do is you can activate that and say, show me what to say. And it will give you a little drop-down list of commands. I think you can also click on that little UI element and get at that list as well. But prior to OS X Yosemite, those commands were fairly limited. You could launch applications. You could close windows. You could move up and down pages, kind of navigate around your Mac. You could even turn on menu commands so you could actually roll through menus and stuff like that. It's actually pretty cool. And you can even do some fun things like ask your Mac to tell you the time or tell you a joke. And if you don't want to have to press a hotkey to enable listening, it even had the ability or has the ability to set up a trigger word. And this can be kind of fun because you can do things like set up, hey, Macintosh, just like you would have, hey, Siri, right? So you can say, hey, Macintosh, and then speak the command that you want it to execute. And again, it works in OS X Mavericks and earlier systems going all the way back to OS 9. Now, what happened in Yosemite and what you're noticing is that the speakable items was actually merged with the core dictation architecture. And the reason some of the commands work, even though you have not enabled the advanced dictation commands, is that they enabled by default some of the commands and functionality. So there's things, it sounds like things like page up and page down, those commands work out of the box without actually having to do any advanced settings. And the other change that they made in OS X Yosemite is they ditched that little round element UI for when the dictation is enabled or the dictation commands are enabled in favor of the standard sort of dictation response heads up interface, the little, you know, square box with a microphone that you see when you hit the, you know, double tap the function key to do dictation. But similarly, if you want to know what commands work with the dictation commands, you can simply say show commands when you're dictating, and it will give you the list of things that you can say. And then, as you noted, there's also the ability to turn on advanced commands, and that's the thing that you do from the accessibility menu. So if you go into System Preferences and click on the Dictation and Speech System Preference pane, make sure you click on Enable Dictation if you haven't done that already. But once that's enabled, you get that set of basic commands. And then within that, you can select the option to use Enhanced Dictation. That will let you be able to dictate when you're offline and not connected to the internet. And then once you've done that, you can go to accessibility, the accessibility system preference pane, and then you should have the dictation option in that list on the left of the accessibility pane. And from there, you can click the dictation commands button and see a list of the available commands that are available there. And then also enable the advanced commands. And once you check on that enable advanced commands option, then that opens up a whole giant word of or world of dictation commands. And you can even at that point add your own commands from the advanced commands window. And within advanced commands that you set up yourself, you can set up automator workflows and do all kinds of crazy stuff, right? But within there, you'll have that list of all the different commands that you can issue. And I haven't fully upgraded to OS X Yosemite yet, but I'm really looking forward to checking this out now that I know about it. And we'll have to explore this a bit further. And I'd also like to know, for those of you who start to set up your own advanced commands, what kind of workflows and what kinds of things are you doing with this? But it really opens up kind of this whole world of possibilities. And it's going to be really cool at some point if we can have maybe our iOS devices integrate with this and kind of remotely be able to control things via HomeKit and other technologies. I think we kind of see the hints of this sort of functionality pulling everything together and us maybe getting to that Star Trek future where we can be anywhere in our house and voice commanding our Macs and our appliances and devices and stuff like that. This is really cool, and I'm excited to know about this. And I was unaware that there was this amount of functionality within OS X Yosemite. So I'm very excited to try it out, and thanks, Gary, for highlighting that for us. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iOS. And they just updated PDF Pen to version 2. So if you haven't upgraded, go check that out. And also, while you're checking out the Smile software, check out PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software. You can pick up brand new skills or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. And you can get a free trial of lynda.com by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. They're at CashFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have any feedback for me, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. It's also the place where you can send suggestions for things you'd like to hear covered on future episodes of the MacCast. If you have a question, something you need help with, or just something you want to comment on, just shoot off an audio comment or an email, and I will try to respond either directly or on a future episode. And you can also leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And we also have a Skype voicemail if you'd like to leave a message there and save maybe on some long distance charges. My Skype address is the MacCast. But those are all great ways to get in touch with us. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com, another place where you can leave questions for the community and get help with your Macs and iOS devices, things like that. So be sure to check that out. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and you will find us there. But with that, that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.